Where does forgiveness fit in my life, in your life, and our collective lives as a society when transgressions are forced upon us? Forgiveness is a fruitful topic for sermons. Joseph Bednarik discussed it with us in November and Bruce Bode just a few weeks ago. In my decades of attending Unitarian Universalist churches, I recall sermons on this topic that I heard from Minneapolis and Ohio pulpits. This one sermon topic stays with me more than most. I am still figuring forgiveness out. Joseph planted the seeds of this service when he shared in his talk last November that his church camera person who was filming his talk questioned whether Dick Cheney, the architect of the 2003 war with Iraq, had worth and dignity. Joseph credited Cheney with inherent worth and dignity. That got me thinking about Cheney and forgiveness, showing that whatever is preached, the listener hears and interprets as he wants. I outlined today's service or sermon, at least the start of it, that November Sunday afternoon. To answer Joseph now about Cheney, Cheney long ago squandered his inherent worth and dignity. Did he lose it? I don't know about that, but he buried it under one evil deed after another. His climb back to dignity is through taking responsibility and reconciling, a multi-party shared process, and yes, asking for forgiveness. He has lots of work in front of him if he chooses to try. Our immediate reflections on forgiveness tend to be for wrongs done to us and our struggle to forgive, especially when the transgressor does not take responsibility. In our discussion that Sunday morning after Bruce spoke, Mike Murdoch and Susie Wilson each recounted past pain years and decades ago of having been done wrong with only them and the sinner, to use a word, present. Mike and Susie worked to find forgiveness on their own. But what are the people who hurt them? What is their role and what are their responsibilities and they're being held to account so they do not harm again? And what about the torn fabric of their own lives that they create pain for others? The biggest wounds in my life are, of course, the most personal. From my father, Bernie, and my former wife, Wendy. My dad is now 20 years dead, and Wendy has chosen not to speak with me in 15 years. In the year after my father died, whenever I discussed him with my mom, she asked me to forgive him. That was not helpful, not to me, and I don't think to the family. It was not honest, and it was not fair. It was a sweep things under the rug, put the past behind us sentiment. It did not address my pain, and it left my mom and siblings off with no work on their part. When Bruce spoke to us, he told us forgiveness is not about forgetting. And he said to us, how can you ever and why should you ever forget the deep hurts and wounds that are so much a part of your life, even when they might be largely healed? If you do forget, you're more likely to get wounded again in the same place. So forgive, but also don't be afraid to remember. And he quoted Lewis Smedes, who wrote a book, Forgive and Forget. And I'll quote Smedes also from Bruce's sermon. Smedes wrote, you do not excuse people by forgiving them. You forgive them at all only because you hold them to account and you refuse to excuse them. You do not forgive people by smothering conflict. If you forever smother people's differences, you rob them of a chance to forgive. You do not have to tolerate what people do when you forgive them for doing it. You may forgive people, but still refuse to tolerate what they have done. That's from Smedes. So I titled this sermon, Where Forgiveness Fits. Forgiveness is a process, of course, but it is also a value, a moral value, that is. It fits in a hierarchy of our ethics, the ways we rank how we behave with others. For me, loyalty is a value that is not as critical as, that is, it's lower on my hierarchy than honesty. Respect is a value, but I place that below truth. I consider forgiveness a personal trait and contrast it with justice, which has critical social dimensions for our larger society and indeed for civilization. And now, Smead had written, "We forgive people at all only because you hold them to account and refuse to excuse them." Critical to forgiveness, whether for a personal act against me or any of us, or actions damaging an entire society, is that there are two parties, one causing harm to the other. Holding the person to account is a social action provided by the web of the community. The social fabric is torn, and repair starts with naming those who have ripped it asunder. With my father, when my family recognizes my story and names his role and holds him responsible, they are recognizing my pain and its source. They are seeing my wound. Healing of all parties can only start when the victimized is held in the light and love of truth. Bruce told us that forgiveness is essentially an internal process, typically a slow one, that takes place in the heart and the mind of the person who feels injured or wronged by another. It is an internal process for all parties, the wrong, the transgressor, and the larger community, whether that is a family or a country or two countries, as with the U.S. war with Iraq, which caused immense damage to everyone. A little bit more on that later. When the ruling party in South Africa negotiated giving up power to the African National Congress, the social and political movement led by Nelson Mandela in 1994, essential to the transition to majority rule was a long-term, well-organized, and structured Truth and Reconciliation Commission, a court-like restorative justice body. Here are the important parts of holding a person or people to account: recognition of the truth by all sides responsible for the actions, the light of day, the public, and the genuine willingness for all parties to work toward reconciliation. Bruce brought up justice when he spoke to us, pointing out that without justice, the victims are at the mercy of their perpetrators. And he also said the principle of forgiveness is undermined without justice. Justice ensures accountability with the act of forgiveness. This reinforces that justice is social in the community for the benefit of all of us. In working toward, for the benefit of all of us, that justice is working toward repairing the social fabric purposely ripped asunder. So I'll give you the punchline now. When I hear forgiveness, I think justice. What does honesty and fairness require? The truth. But the truth has to be spoken in the light of day with all sides in agreement. Mike and Susie came to a peace within themselves, or at least an acceptance, but the transgressors, the persons who acted badly, were not held accountable. Mike and Susie's efforts at a personal peace leaves bad actors free to act badly again. What I wanted for my family with my father was to be heard and recognized. Forgiveness grows in public, not because the grievance is aired, but because others recognize the truth that a wrong took place, that an injustice was done, and that for the torn fabric, be it between father and son, a professor and student, or a war criminal and two societies torn asunder, each will only mend in the light of truth. Reconciliation begins in the light of day with empathy and recognizing the pain, with understanding the pain was willfully caused, and then with a group commitment to holding the transgressor accountable. The sinner can only heal when he speaks the truth and asks to be let into the circle of humanity by naming the wrongs he committed and following up with healing action. The wrongdoer heals by his asking for forgiveness and in time forgiving himself. I have spoken before of my respect and admiration for Catholic nuns who marched and worked through the Vietnam War and into the nuclear freeze movement prompted by Ronald Reagan's presidency, chanting and insisting, without justice, there is no peace. The deep abiding peace that all of us can be a part of is one that recognizes the depth of pain and world broken open by the transgressor, whether it is to a son, a student, or a nation, and to stop everything until the light of justice provides its healing rays. The prophets did not preach for forgiveness to roll down like waters. No, Amos demanded that let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Yes, my father is a source for this sermon, along with Dick Cheney and Joseph Bednarik, but so are Cheney's partner in war crimes, Donald Rumsfeld and George W. Bush. I remember a sermon in Oxford, Ohio, around 2007 on forgiveness that prompted the question and after-service discussion. Talkbacks were a common feature in our church culture decades back. The question, actually, we kind of do that when our post-service Zoom discussions, but talkbacks were a common feature with us gathering in a circle in the sanctuary after church. The question in 2007 came up about forgiving Bush for the destruction of Iraq. My response was immediate. None of us has a part in forgiving George Bush. That's between him and his God. That is not our role. Our role is to address the evil he wrought on two continents and to demand justice on ours. Not to get into the weeds or minutiae of 2009, but President Barack Obama did the nation and the world a tremendous disservice when he prevented the U.S. Senate from holding hearings on the Bush administration's concerted efforts to create the war with Iraq. Truth is served by the light of day. This is how we move toward justice. Preventing the facts from coming out did not heal the nation. Obama preventing the truth from being pursued led to the sense that our two political parties are alike and corrupt and provided an opening for the demagoguery of Donald Trump. Lies will fill the space left by the absence of truth. But this is a religious sermon and not a political rant. Before I or anyone here today spend time working on forgiving Bush or Cheney, I challenge you to challenge them for their lack of sense, their lack of compassion, and for the very real blood they have on their hands. The best way to help Dick Cheney is to bring him to justice and help him to reconcile his deeds with deaths of the individuals and the whole of two societies that he ruined. Dick Cheney's path to his salvation lies squarely on the road of truth. This is our challenge as people of religious conviction, to find our part in helping evildoers become accountable for their actions and walk with them on their path toward their recognition and responsibility for reconciling with those they have harmed. They are the ones in need of asking for forgiveness. We are not in the business of saving anyone in our faith movement, but we could be helping people rediscover and rebuild their worth and dignity. With war criminals, we are challenged to live up to our second principle, which is to promote justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. Today's reading, as Ken said, is from the Old Testament, the prophet Amos and the book of Amos. he was not happy with the leaders of his established order telling them, I hate, I despise your feasts, and that he took no delight in your solemn assemblies. He rejected their offerings, even their fattened animals and their songs. What does he tell them? But let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. He does not call for forgiveness to roll down like waters, having called them out for their hypocrisy and worship when he said at the beginning, woe to you who desire the day of the Lord. His litany of criticisms ends with a call for justice. Now, I don't have children, but my friends always have. I learned an important lesson from my friend George in the early 1990s in his backyard in Cincinnati. George has two sons, Tony and Simon. Then Tony was maybe 8 and Simon was about 6. As older brothers do, Tony did a bad thing to Simon. And maybe Simon cried. George came outside to find out what was going on. He heard Simon's side of the story. He asked Tony for his version. He then told Tony to apologize to Simon. Tony gave a half-hearted, maybe head-down mumbling of, I'm sorry. That was not enough for his dad. George did the responsible fatherly duty, hoping Tony would learn something. Tony, he said, tell Simon why you are sorry. Tell him what you are sorry for. And I learned a lesson of the need to take responsibility for wronging another and naming what you are apologizing for. So thank you, George, for teaching me that. Justice is a matter of holding people accountable. A first step is having all parties recognize the transition and the wrongdoer take ownership. Our religious responsibility is to initiate and insist on justice and equity, not just preach or sing about it. Our work for justice starts with advocating for freeing and protecting the oppressed. But our historic theology and present principles inform us that salvation is possible for everyone, even Dick Cheney. And what's more, our faith fails Cheney if it does not offer him a path to gain salvation, to find peace in his own soul, and help him be able to forgive himself. Mark Morrison Reed is one of our best ministers. Now retired, he served our Toronto church for decades. He is an author and scholar and has written many books on racial injustice within our own Unitarian Universalist movement. I heard him preach in Minneapolis years ago on a quite different topic that he titled his sermon, Dragging the Last Universalist Kicking and Screaming into Heaven. Think about that title for a moment. Dragging the Last Universalist Kicking and Screaming into Heaven. Our Universalist faith with the theology that all of us go universally to heaven. Mark's point was that even non-believers get to heaven, even if they don't want to go, don't believe in our belief. Our God is so great and so loving that everyone gets to heaven. So I have said in defining universalist theology to the uninitiated and the dumbfounded that yes, even Adolf Hitler gets to heaven. But if I am not wrong, if that defines universalism, then our historic faith is fundamentally weak. Why does Dick Cheney get a pass and into heaven when he has not been brought to justice in his lifetime? That's not fair. It lets the rest of us off the hook. It does not heal the pain of those he has harmed. Dick Cheney not having justice during our lifetimes is our failure. What type of religious faith do we have if we individually and collectively do not hold him to account, do not hear the cries of our broken brothers and sisters, both in Iraq and here at home, and act as a judge for them, ourselves, and our just future? I don't remember where I heard or read that universalism as a faith failed enslaved people in all the centuries of their bondage. What kind of faith tells enslaved people that their owners will join them in heaven? What enslaved person would join that so-called religious movement? What tin ear weakness and theological blindness was present that our forefathers did not pursue theological complexity to meet enslaved people's needs? Ours cannot be a naive or simple faith. While I do not believe that evil exists independently as a force like gravity, I have long held a definition for the very real evil that people choose to perpetuate. People doing bad things on purpose are evil acting people. Whatever is the source leading to their twisted deeds, their actions are evil. And yet, if our principle is to work toward justice and compassion, we cannot leave the sinner behind. Even after Dick Cheney has torn our social fabric asunder, he is part and not outside of the human community. Like Joseph Benarnik, I am concerned with Dick Cheney's inherent worth and dignity. What is our responsibility to get him to be responsible? Mark Morrison Reed writes, as we will hear soon in our closing words, the central task of the religious community is to unveil the bonds that bind each to all. There is a connectedness, a relationship discovered amid the particulars of our own lives and the lives of others. We are bound to the evildoers too. Our task then is to help them see that they have bonds that bind them to us, to Iraqi children and widows, to the descendants of people enslaved centuries ago. I started off with the terms fairness and honesty. The truest cliche there ever was, and the most needed commandment not explicitly spelled out in the Bible, is a simple sentence, speak truth to power. John, the Gospel of John, in the chapter 8 and verse 32, tells us, then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. If we want peace, we work for justice. For a 360-degree, full-circle embrace of forgiveness that sees the transgressor free in his sins, we must demand from him and stay with him through a reconciliation process where the victim's truths are aired to the world in the light of day, and the transgressor tells the truth of his role in bringing harm and destruction to others. It is the only way to help his victims and for Dick Cheney to heal. That is how he makes it into heaven, kicking and screaming, and how we, a justice-seeking people, can walk alongside him, reaching toward justice. And may it be so.